and shared with his disciples what he really wanted them to pray for. And then secondly, we saw that when Jesus was in the cul-de-sac of sorrow and trouble, he, instead of looking to the right or to the left or behind him or for a way to get out, he couldn't get out. Providence had brought him to that place where he was going to go to that tree. And so instead of looking every direction about him, he looked up. He looked up to where his source of power and strength and sustenance was, and that is the same for us. But now this evening, I'd like for us to consider a third observation on the praying life of Jesus, and it is this. Persistent prayer is primarily for the purpose of aligning our will with our Father in heaven. Now, there's a lot there, and I'm going to take some time to unpack it tonight, but let me just repeat that one more time. Persistent prayer is primarily for the purpose of aligning our will with our Father in heaven. Now, I want you to notice a few things under this heading, and the first thing is this. Persistence is key in prayer. I want you to notice, and some of you made this observation a few weeks ago, it was three times that Jesus prayed for the same thing. He prayed, Father, if it be your will, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, your will be done. The second, and then he went and checked on his disciples, and there they were sleeping, told them to get up and watch and pray. And then he comes back, and he prays the same thing, a little different wording, but it's in substance the same thing. And then he goes back, he finds his disciples sleeping, tells them to watch and pray, and then he comes back a third time, and it says in verse 44, he prayed the same thing. Now again, these prayer requests are basically two ways of saying the same thing. If it be possible for my request to be part of your divine will, let it happen. And what we can take away from that on a very practical level is we need more than one prayer. We need more than a long prayer. We need more than a verbose prayer. What we need is to be persistent in prayer. And we saw this, did we not? In the book of Habakkuk, which literally probably means from a Syriac word, wrestler. Habakkuk was a wrestler with God. And here we see Jesus in the garden. We see in another place, and perhaps in different words, that he sweat drops of blood. This was the nature of his persistent prayer. Going before God and wrestling with him in prayer. It wasn't a flippant prayer. It wasn't a casual prayer. And certainly there are times for that, right? We're on the highway. We're driving to work. We're trying to, you know, watch all of our mirrors and make sure we're staying in the same lane and make sure our speed is correct so we don't get pulled over. And maybe we pray. And there's a place for that. But there's also a place for putting everything else aside, putting our phone far away, turning all the notifications off, turning our computer off, turning the TV off, getting alone, and wrestling with God in prayer. Not just giving up one prayer or a long prayer or a verbose prayer, but persistently coming before him and asking that he would hear our prayers. Prayer is putting yourself in the bullseye of the Lord's will. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but let me just say this. Sometimes when I, for example, have conflict with somebody, you guys know something of that, you have conflict with somebody, and I'm troubled about it, and I'm anxious about it, and I start worrying, and I start going through all those different stages of fear and doubt and speculation and prognostication about what they might be thinking about me, I know that what I need to do is I need to go to the Lord in prayer. And actually, what I do is I play out a conversation with that person in my prayer to the Lord. You say, that's kind of weird, Josh. Well, think about it for a second. I'm not just asking the Lord to give me wisdom with that person. I'm not just asking the Lord to change that person's heart. But what am I also doing? I'm asking the Lord to modify and change my heart. And so one of the things I do, and I find it helpful, is my mind is racing in 1,000 different directions, and I'm thinking about what I need to say to that person, how I need to say it to that person. So I just say, Lord, here's what I'm going to say to this person. And I have that conversation. And then after I get done with that conversation, I say, Lord, now was my tone right? Should I use this word? Should I use another word? What am I doing? I'm wrestling with God in prayer. And there's a place for that. And you know what? That is one of the most practical ways in which you can take anxiety, Okay? You're worrying about how you need to handle this person, how you need to handle that situation, and literally cut and paste it into a prayer and go before the Lord and say, Lord, help me with my words. Help me with my tone. Help me, Father, to be one whose words are seasoned with salt, as it were. So there's not vile coming out or bile coming out, but what there is there's grace coming out and they could hear my heart. There's nothing wrong with that. Ask the Lord to tweak your motive and your tone and your words to be edifying, wise, and gracious. But now here's the second thing I want you to notice. Jesus' purpose in prayer was to align his own will with the will of the Father. Now here, there's some paradoxical things here that I've been punting for the last few weeks, and then there's some practical things. So let me start with the hard stuff, okay? When we think about this prayer, when Jesus says, if it be your will, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but your will be done. We need, in order to kind of figure out what is going on there, we need to go back to the early creeds of Christianity to understand the nature of Jesus so that we can get a sense of what is going on here. And thankfully, the early creeds of the Orthodox Church have given us a way to think about the nature of Jesus. So the first thing we want to remember is that Jesus had two natures. Okay, everybody remember that. Jesus had two natures. He had a human nature and a divine nature. And just a little aside, as you deal with Jehovah's Witnesses and other cults and isms, be careful not to say things like Jesus was 100% God, 100% man. That is illogical, but it's logical to say Jesus was fully God and fully man. Okay? When you're talking to cults and isms and you say something like 100% this, 100% that, they're like, that doesn't make any sense. And you want to try to meet them where you can without crossing the line into heterodoxy. But he had two natures. He was fully God and fully man. And the Creed of Chalcedon in 451 tells us this. Let me just read a little section from the creed, the formula or the definition, as we call it, of Chalcedon, which was pounded out on the anvils of Christological controversies, where the church said, we've got to set up some fences and declare what Jesus was and was not. And on the one hand, they were fighting against those who were saying that Jesus was not God. He was just man or like a superhuman, okay? And then there's others who were saying that he was not man. He was either an appearance or an angel or fully God, but not man, and just came in a theophany of sorts. He just appeared as a man. And so what they were trying to do to save the church from heterodoxy, which is heresy, false teaching, and keep them in orthodoxy, which is straight praise or straight teaching, correct teaching, is say, let's draw some lines and create some fences. And so, for example, the Creed of Chalcedon said, one and the same Christ, Son, Lord, only begotten, recognized in two natures, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation, the distinction of natures being in no way annulled by the union, but rather the characteristics of each nature being preserved and coming together to form one person and subsistence, not as parted or separated into two persons, but one and the same Son and only begotten God, the Word, the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, that's very important. I know to some of you are like, that's very academic, but you need to understand how to understand Jesus' person and nature so that, number one, you can defend against heresy, but secondly, so that you could worship him correctly. So Jesus had two natures, and then in the Sixth Ecumenical Council in 681, Council of Constantinople, they came along and clarified things just a little bit more, and they said, if it's true that Jesus had two natures, it's also true that he had two wills, okay? So the council ruled that Christ's full humanity necessitated that he have a human will distinct from his divine will. So he's got a divine will and a divine nature and a human will and a human nature, and these are not confused, and they are not separated. Now, what do they mean by they're not separated? It doesn't mean that they're not distinct, for they are distinct. It means that they're not separated under the umbrella of the person of Jesus Christ. Because there were some heresies that were saying, yeah, there's two wills because he was two persons. And they came along and said, no, he's not two persons, it's only one person. If you say that Jesus is two persons, then now we don't have a trinity, but we have a quad, right? We have four persons. But there are three persons and one essence. So just reviewing, we have two natures, human and divine, two wills, human and divine. Now, as we consider Jesus' request here, I want to look at it from two different perspectives, the paradoxical and the common. So here's the paradoxical first. There does seem to be an apparent contradiction between Jesus' omniscience as God and his request that the cup pass. What is omniscience? Omniscience is that he knows all things. And as God, it is true, we could say that the person Jesus Christ, is omniscient. But now here is where theology begins to be very helpful. Because we can talk, and I'll say more about this in a minute, we can talk about the person Jesus Christ doing something, speaking something, willing something, but then we can descend from there and talk about Jesus qua his human nature, that is, according to his human nature, and Jesus qua his divine nature. Because think about it for a second. On the one hand, we want to say God cannot die, right? But on the other hand, we want to say Jesus Christ, who is God, died. Now that's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? And it seems as if there is a contradiction there. What is a contradiction? A is A and A is not A. That's a contradiction. And as the Christian religion, we have an aversion toward contradiction because God is the God of logic. So how do we square these things out? Well, let me specify the question more clearly. Here's the question. If Jesus knew that he was going to die, not only because he is God, but also because it was one of the covenant stipulations to which he agreed with the Father in the covenant of redemption in eternity past, then why would he pray for the cup to pass? So let's establish a few contextual matters before we answer this question. First off, the cup that he was asking to pass was certainly the gruesome death upon the cross. So here's the nub of the issue. The nub of the issue is we know that God is omniscient, that is, he knows all things. So the question is, how is the divine attribute of omniscience understood within the context of the incarnation? So I've already told you some of the tension areas. God can't die, but Jesus, who is God, died. God never slumbers nor sleeps. Did Jesus slumber and sleep? Yes. God doesn't need to eat. Did Jesus eat? Yeah, we have a record of him eating fish. Okay? Jesus was fatigued. God is never fatigued. So how do we understand this? Well, let me say a few things. Number one, we start with the principle of the incarnation. Now, in Philippians 2:7, it says that Jesus emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant. Now, that word has caused no little bit of controversy, but what some in the last 200 years have sought to say is that what Jesus emptied was he emptied his divine attributes, omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, all those things. Another way to put it, he voluntarily gave up his right to divine attributes. So he just gave them up. He's not going to use them, and he's going to take the form of a bondservant. Now, I think that this is actually contrary to what our confessions say, because our confessions say that Jesus was fully God and fully man. There were times when he knew things that only God could know. There were times when he did things like miracles that only God can do. So the way to sort this out is to say that Jesus, though he had all the attributes and powers of God, only accessed them when it was his Father's will. And I think that that's the orthodox answer. Okay? So it's not that Jesus abandoned or gave up the rights of his divine attributes. He had his divine attributes the whole time in the person of Jesus Christ. And yet his human nature always remained a human nature, and his divine nature always remained a divine nature. But what is the thing that Jesus always says through the Gospels? What does he always say? He always says, I have come to do my what? My Father's will. And what's interesting is when he turned the water into the wine, remember, Mary came to him and said, hey, the water's run out. And he said, hey, what does this have to do with me? It's not yet my Father's time. And then like probably 2 minutes later, he turned the water into wine. So from the time that she asked him to the time that he turned into wine, it became the Father's time. He was not working on his own agenda. Could he have turned the water into wine? Yes. Could he have turned the stones into bread when Satan tempted him? Absolutely he could have. It's not a matter of could he, it's a matter of what he chooses to access in his divine nature according to the will of the Father. So everything he does is according to the will of the Father. So I would even venture to say that when Jesus says toward the end of Matthew, nobody knows the time or hour when basically I'm going to come back and judge all things, only the Father in heaven, I would submit to you with many theologians that Jesus, qua his divine nature, did in fact know the time. But he was speaking according to his human nature. He was not accessing that information under the umbrella of the person of Jesus Christ. And he does this throughout his ministry. But here's the second thing I would say. When we butt up against things that we don't understand, like how Jesus could be hungry, tired, thirsty, and even ignorant of certain things, it's appropriate, as I said, to talk about Jesus, the person, acting and speaking or willing according to his human nature or according to his divine nature. When we consider that Jesus was about to take the cup of divine wrath, it's perfectly understandable that in his human nature, he would be reluctant to do so. And here's where we need to just stop for a minute and say this. If you as a human, even as a sinless human, were in Jesus' place, would you say, oh yeah, I can't wait to go to the cross. That's going to be totally fine. No problem whatsoever. Of course you wouldn't. It's one thing for God, in even his omniscience, to know as the God-man that he's going to the cross. It's another thing for him to actually experience it. And that's what we need to keep in mind. And I think that sometimes in our minds, in our fights against the Jehovah's Witnesses and our fights against the Mormons who deny the deity of Jesus Christ, we so want to bolster the deity of Jesus Christ that we forget about his what? About his humanity, about his emotional and psychological state, which was very much similar to ours. And by the way, that's the whole point of the incarnation. Was Jesus accessing his divine knowledge here and knowing that he would go to the cross? Probably. But think of the exceeding turmoil that his soul was experiencing at this time. Though he knew it, though he determined it, now as a human being, he was going to experience it. It was through experiences such as this that Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 through 9 makes sense. You don't need to turn there, but listen very carefully to Hebrews 5, 7 through 9. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. So it was through experiences such as this that the sinless God-man learned obedience through what he suffered. And I would submit to you that even going through the emotional and psychological anguish of praying in the garden, asking the Lord that the cup would pass, but then he follows it up three times with, but not my will, but your will be done, we see that he is being perfected through suffering. And that is why he was the only one qualified to be the atonement for sin. So here's the third thing I would say. Does this answer all the questions of logic and coherence? I don't think it does. I don't think it does. And I would submit to you that the early creeds never intended to resolve all the logical and even theological knots that come with trying to understand the incarnation. As I said, they were just setting up fences. Don't fall into the ditch of Apollinarianism. Don't fall into the ditch of Arianism. Don't fall into these ditches, but here's what we must confess, because we're trying to take what Scripture says here and here and here, and we're trying to put them together, and they say, this is what we must confess. What they were not saying is, we understand it all. They weren't saying that. The Creed of Chalcedon didn't say that. The Creed of Constantinople didn't say that. The Nicene Creed didn't say that. No creed has tried to figure out logically how it fits together. And this is where we must have a place in our theology for what is called paradox. Paradox is not a contradiction. A contradiction is A and A is not A. A paradox is an apparent contradiction that we don't see where the two come together. There's something blocking our view, our conception, whatever, of how they come together, and that's called paradox. And paradox could be as a result of a few things. Number one, what we call the noetic effects of sin, which is to say the effects of sin on our mind. Okay? Sin has so messed up our noetic features, our mind features, that we can't comprehend things perfectly. Another thing is that we need to remember the creator-creature distinction. God is infinite and we are finite. There are some people out there that say when we get to heaven, we're going to totally understand the Trinity. I may be a minority, but I think even in heaven, we're not going to understand the Trinity. I don't think we're going to understand it. I don't even know that we're going to understand the incarnation, to be honest with you. Why? Because it's not a matter of, well, if we just get rid of sin, then the finite can comprehend the infinite. No, I don't think the finite can comprehend the infinite. I think the whole purpose of the creator-creature distinction is to say, as Paul says in Romans 9, who are you, O man, to talk back to God? There is this distinction between man and God, and what we will have in heaven is Jesus. We will see him, and we will be like him. Will I understand God and all his multifaceted greatness? No. And that's why forever we're going to worship him. So I think that we need to have a place for paradox in our theology. It's not contradiction, but here's the thing. At a very practical level, my wife and I, as we're catechizing our children, we went through this with Cohen, and it wasn't a problem because I think it was 4 when we taught him this lesson, or these questions, but now we're teaching Caleb, who's 3, and there's 2 questions in the catechism. The first one is, are there more gods than one? And he's got that one. No, there's only one God. And then I go to the next question. You guys know what it is? In how many persons does this one God exist? There is only one God. I said, no, Caleb, no. We're talking about persons now. There's one God, but how many persons? And he's just really having a hard time. He's 3 years old. We should expect that. But as a practical point, it is important from an early age that we begin to teach our children this mystery, this paradox of the Trinity. Because the Trinity is part of the warp and woof of our very worship. We come to the Father through the Son and the power of the Spirit. And the Trinity is absolutely crucial for understanding our worship. So we need to have a place for paradox. Let me just say a few comments then as we close out the common. I've talked about the paradoxical in Jesus' prayer. Now here's the common. And here's where we can take Jesus' prayer as a matrix for us. Okay? Jesus was not so much repeating the same prayer in order to fill up his prayer time as much as he was seeking to bring his will in alignment with the will of the Father. I want you to think for just a moment, listen to me, about how we can make this a matrix for our prayers. If you grasp the whole concept of what prayer is, you will come to the throne of grace with 2 overarching expectations. Here's the first one. You come to the throne of grace expecting God to hear you, expecting God to hear your request. And that's something that we all get. We all get that prayer is asking for something. But here's the second thing. We come to the throne of grace so that the Lord would conform our hearts to what his will is in the matter. In other words, just as Jesus did, not my will, but your will be done. So when we come to the Lord, it's not so much, Lord, will you do this? But Lord, will you do this if it be your will? And if it's not your will, Father, cause my heart to come into conformity for what you're going to cause to bring out in your providence. Because I don't want my heart to be surprised by it, and I don't want my heart to recoil at it, and I don't want my heart to be put off by your actions and your hand in history. I want my knees to drop at whatever you do and worship you. But in order for that to happen, you, Father, you have to conform my heart to your will. That's what we're doing in prayer. And if you've never heard of that, or you've just got a faint idea or a whisper of what that means, you need to make that the center of what prayer is. Not asking for things, that's important, but asking that the Lord would conform your heart to his will. I want you to think of prayer as placing ourselves on a potter's wheel, as a lump. And that lump has a purpose, that our requests be answered in the way that we want it, but that what we should do is expect that the Lord would reshape that lump if it is his good pleasure to do so. So prayer is not primarily about getting what we think that we want. Prayer is about bringing our wills in subjection to the will of the Father. It's the means by which our wills are brought into alignment with the divine will. And the reason why we can ask for specific things, that is because we don't know what the secret will of the Father is. And you know what? I'm glad that I don't know. I'm glad that I don't know. In our ignorance of God's secret will, we are asking that he would work according to what we think we want, but in the process, we're asking him to change and conform our hearts to what he deems best. So how are you coming before the Lord tonight, both in your private and public prayers? Are you coming ready and willing to be changed, or are you merely coming to present your requests? Well, there's a sense in which it's not an either-or. It's a both-and. We're asking the Lord to hear our requests. We're asking the Lord to answer them, but we're also asking the Lord to conform our hearts to his will. And just remember, finally, that Jesus even now is interceding for us in prayer to the Father. Like he prayed for Peter, he prays that Satan would not sift us, but that we would remain strong. We may be poor prayers. We may substitute time on our knees for anxiety and doubt, but our praying does not commend us to God. Jesus' intercession does. Just as the author of Hebrews says in 7:25, consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So in your stumbling, fumbling, prayerless prayers, fix your hope on the one who has done all things well. And look to Jesus tonight and find comfort in his ministry of intercession. Amen. All right, does anybody have any questions about that? I know I gave you a lot to think about tonight. Any questions? Hey, John, could you come up to the microphone, please?
Yeah.
Thanks.
In John 12:27, what would be your view when the Lord says, or how would we understand when he says, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. So in other words, so when he was making those three requests in the Garden of Gethsemane, mm-hmm. we're saying that, at least the way I'm understanding it, is that he was possibly looking for a way out from going to the cross?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm just taking his words at face value. He said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass.
Right, so we were saying that that the cup was the death at the cross. Mm-hmm. So we're supposing that he was asking if it be possible for me not to have to go to the cross, but if that's your ultimate will that I do, then I must. So I'm just asking, what does that mean in relation to what he says in 27?
John
12? 27? Yes, sir.
John 12:27.
It's kind of like the same language at the beginning. And what shall I say? Father, save me from the... Like he's saying, should I say that? If that's the reason that I know I have come, was to redeem...
Yeah, I kind of see this. I mean, just with different language, the same struggle. That he does desire to be saved from this hour, and yet he realizes that the purpose of his life is to come to this hour. And so he comes to the same resolve. Your will be done. Glorify your name. So I see in this the exact
the same model
that he had in Gethsemane, mm-hmm. even if it is a different language, yeah. And I think, again, this just points out his humanity,
mm-hmm.
absolutely his humanity. And we ought not lose sight of his humanity, that he was going to a cross. He knew that he was going there. He obviously accessed his divine knowledge to know this is the purpose. I mean, I think by that point in his ministry, he had read the Torah. He had seen all the prophecies about him. Everything clicked. I don't know how, but everything clicked. He knew that that was his purpose. But on the side of humanity, even a sinless humanity, he struggled with it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've just heard in the past, you know, coming up, that the ultimate penalty of going to the cross, or the ultimate wrath that he felt that he might have suffered, would have been the eternal separation from the Father, not just having sin condemned in his flesh, but having suffered the penalty that, you know, unbelievers will also suffer as you know, an eternal separation from God in the second death, the eternal death. So when we look in Hebrews 5, when it talks about that he offered up prayers to the Lord, to the one who was able to save him from death, if death meant that, the second death, wouldn't it be that the Lord saved him from that death because he rose from the dead?
That's very important because Muslims say that Hebrews 5 says...
Not the physical death.
Well, see, that's what they say. They say
right.
That it refers to the physical death, and that's why Muslims believe that Jesus didn't actually die.
Yeah. He was assumed.
But yes, your interpretation is correct. We take that to be ultimate death, and God saved him from that by resurrecting him. So that's how that prayer was answered.
Through the promise of, let not your Holy One see
that's right.
corruption.
That's
yeah,
right.
In Psalm 16, I believe. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Good.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, thank you, brother. All right.
Can you rephrase that quote from Hebrews and what Muslims believe and how it got answered again?
Yeah, Hebrews chapter 5, very quickly.
Pastor Josh?
Yeah.
Yeah, Christina and I and the boys went to the beach last Sunday after service, and we met a Muslim family, and I ended up talking to him and sharing the gospel with him for about an hour, and he told me that this is their understanding, that God sent a lookalike that looked just like Jesus to die, but that Jesus himself didn't actually die. And they go to Hebrews chapter 5, let's see here, 7... Seven, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. So they say, look, he prayed that the Lord would save him from death, and it says that he was heard, which means that God answered his prayer. So Jesus Christ didn't actually die. And the Orthodox answer has always been, what he was praying for is that, as John was saying, quoting from Psalm 16, that your Holy One would not see decay or corruption, which means that he would resurrect him. So it's not referring to the cup. He knew that he was going to the cup. That was the Father's will. But after the cup consumed him, having come under the Father's wrath, the Father resurrected him so that his prayer was heard and he did not ultimately die. Does that make sense? Okay. All right.
He didn't die the second death.
Right? We could put it that way, yeah. He was kept from death. Certainly. Okay. All right. Well, let's move to prayer time. I just have a few, and then we will hear from you guys.